Greetings and welcome to Word Magazine. This is Jeff Riddle, pastor of Christ Reformed Baptist Church in Louisa, Virginia. And in this episode of Word Magazine, I'm going to be doing a review of a recent YouTube video. The video comes from a pastor named Matthew Everhard, and he put out a statement, a preliminary statement as he called it, declaring himself to be a critical text guy. That he is choosing not to be one who advocates for the received text, but he wants to identify as a critical text guy, which means he's going to use the modern critical text of the Bible, and he's going to use translations based on the modern critical text. So in this episode, I'm just going to do a brief review of this statement. I think his video is about 17 minutes long. And I'm going to play it, stop and start it, and offer some responses. I jotted down a few notes, but it'll be primarily me just be presenting these extemporaneously. I did note that with regard to this statement, Pastor Everhard says this is he wants to just share these new found convictions that he has, but and he does make reference to the fact that he's been thinking about this and studying it for quite a while. And I was aware of a video that he did back in October of 2020, and it's titled Greek Battle, Critical Text versus Textus Receptus. I had seen that. I'd even pondered doing a review of that video, but I never actually got the opportunity to watch all of it, nor to obviously record my own podcast review of it. But from what I heard and saw there, it seems like he's at least held to the modern critical text since October of 2020. I'm not sure what the new convictions that he has that prompted this particular video to come out in 2022. Maybe he read something new that solidified his convictions in this area. He's not really specific in telling us what he's read. Who has he read on the TR side? Who has he read defending the modern critical text? I'm not 100% sure. Everhard, I should have said in the beginning, is pastor of Gospel Fellowship Presbyterian Church, which according to the website is a PCA congregation that's in Valencia, Pennsylvania, which is outside of Pittsburgh. And again, he's got a very active online ministry. He's got a whole lot more subscribers to his YouTube channel than I do, and he presents out crisp, clean material. And I have to say, I don't think I've ever actually watched a complete video. I've watched bits and pieces, so this will be my first video where I've actually watched it from beginning to end. And I watched it ahead of this recording, and now I'm going to get a chance to listen to it again while I offer some feedback. So with that said, let's go ahead and listen to the video from Pastor Matthew Everhard. It's titled on his YouTube channel, Critical Text versus Textus Receptus, Some Preliminary Conclusions, and it was posted April 29 of 2022. As of this, when I'm doing this recording, it has 2,337 views and 144 likes. I will, as always, post an article on my blog at jeffriddle.net. I'll have a link to the original video. You can watch it for yourself, and I'll include probably a couple of other links, including his October 2020 video on the similar topic. But anyways, here we go. Let's listen to Pastor Everhard. And one last thing. The basic structure of this is he makes some preliminary remarks. Then he lays out sort of five arguments or five reasons he's embracing the modern critical text, becoming a critical text guy. And then he offers some concluding thoughts. So that gives you a basic structure as you're listening to it. So here we go.
What's up, everybody? Pastor Matt here. Thanks for checking into the YouTube channel. Hey, today I want to do a kind of a short video just thinking through some issues related to the ongoing discussion between those who advocate for a textus receptus position and those who advocate for a critical text position. This is a matter that I've been thinking about for more than a year, maybe 2 years.
Yeah, so he says he's been thinking about it for a year or two.
Doing a lot of concerted effort on my part to rationally and as objectively and faithfully, thoughtfully thinking through this debate, trying to come to some conclusions on my own. And I've kind of come to the position by this point that I am a critical text guy, as over against a TR-only advocate. And in this short video...
Let me pause for just a moment. So he declares himself to be a critical text guy as opposed to a TR-only advocate. And if you've listened to my podcast or my interactions with other people on this topic, you may well know that I don't really prefer to use the term TR-only or TR-onlyism. Usually that's used by people who are opponents of our position. They're trying to... associate us with King James Version onlyism. The term that I prefer to use is the confessional text position or the traditional text position, or even a TR advocate or received text advocate, because we're not talking just about the New Testament. We're talking about the Old Testament and the New Testament. Right at the very beginning, he said a TR advocate, I think, but here he uses the pejorative TR only. So anyways, I guess people, my thought on this is that people who embrace the modern critical text and who choose not to embrace the received text, the traditional text, I think they recognize that that's why they want to call it TR onlyism, because they realize if they were to say, I reject the traditional Protestant text of the Bible in favor of the new and improved modern critical text, that wouldn't sound very good. So it sounds a lot better to say, I'm rejecting TR-onlyism. That sounds like I'm rejecting KJV-onlyism, as opposed to I'm rejecting the traditional Protestant text of the scriptures. But anyway, what's in a name? Well, names can be important. Titles can be important. Labels can be important. But anyways, let's listen to a little bit more.
I'm not going to go through all of the possible arguments, but I do want to suggest a few things that have been helpful to me to think through these things. A couple of prefactory thoughts here by way of just kind of initiating the discussion between us. First, I really do impute the best possible motives to everybody that is in this so-called debate. I truly regard it as an in-house debate amongst sincere Bible-believing Christians. I'm sure there are those out there that have more dastardly motivations for whatever side they may want to hold on this, but I would assume that the large majority of people who discuss this kind of thing have the best of motivations. They want to know the Lord, they want to truly understand the scriptures, and they want to have the best possible Greek New Testament text.
Well, I appreciate the charitable attitude from Pastor Everhard. I try as best I can to demonstrate something similar, although sometimes that's hard to do, and sometimes, regrettably, I certainly can fall into being a little more acerbic in my tone and sharper in my comments. But I do appreciate that, and I largely agree with it. I don't impugn, evil motives to people who have embraced the modern critical text. In many cases, with respect to Bible college students and seminarians and pastors, it's the only position that they have been exposed to. And so all they know is the modern critical text side, because that's what they were told by their professors. That's what they read in their favorite theologians. And in many cases, they really haven't had an opportunity to examine both sides. And I also know that there's a tendency of those in the modern critical text side to sometimes obscure the actual views of those who are advocates for the traditional text, even to demonize us, certainly by a false association with KJV-onlyism. That can happen. So I really do appreciate a charitable and open-minded approach. And I certainly want to do the same when I treat people who have a view that is the opposite of mine. So let's continue.
Applying their English translations and so forth. This is largely, of course, a scholarly debate. And so, as many people have said previous times before, whether you choose the Textus Receptus, which is the Greek New Testament text of the Reformation era, underlying some of the great old translations such as the King James Version, also more modernly the New King James Version, etc., or whether you advocate for a critical text position, we all know that whatever side you fall on, the real difference in your Bible is very, very small.
All right, let me pause here for just a moment and offer some observations. Firstly, he says, we all know this is simply, or this is largely a scholarly debate. And that is partially true in that it is a debate among people who are scholars. Actually, there are a lot more so-called credentialed scholars on the modern critical text side than there are on the advocacy for the received text, at least in this generation, not true of in past generations. But at any rate, it's not just a scholarly issue in the end, I would add, with due respect to Pastor Eberhard. It is a practical issue, and it is a popular issue, because it's a matter of what Bible is the average Christian going to read in his spiritual devotions? What Bible is the average pastor going to use as he preaches and teaches? And so this issue, although it might begin in the ivory towers of academia, the conversation might take place there, it also trickles down to the pew, as my friend Howie Jones is fond of saying. It's not just, you know, the seminary lectern. It's not even just the pulpit, but it's the pew. How does this trickle down to the average person in the pew? Now, let me also address, he says, in the end, he wants to downplay the significance of the difference between the modern critical text and the received text. If there are real differences between the modern critical text and the received text, then why do we have a modern critical text? If the differences aren't that large, why don't you just embrace the received text then? Why don't you just stick with that rather than going to something new and supposedly improved? In fact, the differences between the modern critical text and the received text are not minor differences. These are not small differences. They are significant differences. If you pick up, for example, and I often suggest people look at this, the textual key that is printed by the Trinitarian Bible Society, and you can find it for free online. You can find a PDF of it, or you can order a printed hard copy of it. But the TBS, or Trinitarian Bible Society, textual key, just Google that, and you should be able to find a link to the free PDF. That document lists 650 significant textual variants between the received text and the modern critical text. And even that listing of 650 in the New Testament is not exhaustive. That really only scratches the surface. There are thousands of differences between the received text and the typical printing of the modern critical text. In addition, as I've noted many times, if you embrace the modern critical text, that means you would abandon the authenticity of the traditional ending of Mark 16, 9 through 20, 12 verses. You would also abandon the idea of the authenticity, originality of the woman taken in adultery, John 7:53 through 8:11. That's 12 verses. And so does that sound like a small difference to you? If we were to talk about removing 12 verses from Mark, removing 12 verses from John, just those two variants alone, we're talking about 24 verses. That's the equivalent of removing one of our smaller books within the canon of the New Testament. That would be like trying to remove 2 John or 3 John or even the book of Jude. So it's not a small matter. The difference between the modern critical text and the received text, the differences are not insignificant. So let's let him continue his preliminary remarks before he goes on to his five arguments.
That's been said many times before. And not only that, but even though I have sort of recently come to the critical text position, I do still have a great respect and admiration for those of you who disagree with me. So this is not a polemical video. This is not some kind of...
Well, it kind of is a polemical video, let's face it. But you can make your argument charitably, and he generally succeeds in doing that.
Shot across the bow on my part to those who disagree. There are good guys out there. I know Jeff Riddle. I doubt maybe he watches my channel. I don't know.
Hey, that's my name. Yeah, Jeff Riddle. I am watching your video right now. Actually, as I said, this is the first one I've watched all of, but I have watched some of your previous videos, particularly the one that you did in October of 2020 relating to text. And I've dipped in from time to time at a few others addressing other topics. I know that Pastor Eberhard did a dialogue with a friend of mine who's a Reformed Baptist minister over whether or not Reformed Baptists could rightly be called Reformed. I didn't watch all of that one either, but I did watch a little bit of it. And so anyways, yeah, we do follow each other on Twitter, and I have no animosity against him, and I know he doesn't against me, but we ought to feel free to express our views. I'm happy for him to freely express his views, and I just reserve the right privilege to be able to express my own. And hopefully, yes, we can do that in a charitable manner.
Follows me on Twitter, but I impute the best kind of possible motivations to him and others out there who hold the Textus Receptus position. But again, I have done quite a bit of objective pondering on that, and so I figured I'd just very briefly mention a few things that have led me in the direction of the critical text. Number one, and I think I'll have five here, I truly want to have all of the data before me.
Okay, this is the first of his five arguments or five reasons that he has become a modern critical text guy. And this first one is, he says, I want to have all the data before me. And his presupposition here is that by embracing the modern critical text, you're embracing taking into account all the data related to, he's going to talk primarily about the New Testament, not the Old Testament, all the data related to the transmission history of the New Testament. And so let me let him just present more of his position, and then I'll offer some critiques of it along the way.
I have been working through the Greek New Testament for my devotions for more than a year now. It's taken me longer than I thought. I'm in 1 Peter. I'm getting sort of to the close here in the next couple months or so before I move on to the Septuagint of the Old Testament. And one day I was reading my Greek New Testament, this very one here, this is the UBS 4 that I have in my hand, and I was looking down at the notes, and I was almost brought to tears because one particular text had a difficult reading, and this simple book in my hand, the UBS 4, had citations from the majority text, from the medieval text, from the minuscules, from the majuscules, from the papyri. It mentioned some Latin, some Syriac, it had patristic quotations, and I thought to myself, my goodness, I am so thankful that I have in the critical text access to so many manuscripts and fragments throughout all of the ages, more than we've ever had at any point in Christian history.
All right, let me pause here for just a moment. So he starts off with this first of his five arguments. Is he says that I want to have all the data before me. And so here's my response to that. You may want to have all the data before you, but in truth, you simply cannot have all the data before you. And you can't have all the data for several reasons. When you say you want all the data, what you really mean is I want all the extant data. I want all the data, whether it's papyri or vellum manuscripts. I want all the things that have survived the transmission process. But there's a lot more material that is permanently lost or was destroyed. And so you cannot have access to all the data. And one of the arguments I've made many times is that because of the early persecutions of Christianity, in particular the Diocletian persecution of the early 4th century, We don't have access, actually, to very many early manuscripts of the New Testament because they were destroyed through persecution or they've been worn out through wear. In fact, we don't have a whole lot of early extant evidence. That's kind of one point. So there's a major failure, as I see it, with the empirical approach, the reconstruction approach, because it doesn't recognize the fact that we actually don't have a wide and certainly not exhaustive sampling of the data of the New Testament and its transition from transmission in early Christianity. He mentions using his UBS, United Bible Society's fourth edition. That's what he's reading through, I think, devotionally and translating the scriptures. And he talks about having an emotional moment when he looked in the apparatus. My response to that is this. First of all, let's say you have that UBS handbook. Well, those couple of notes that you have in the apparatus, that's not telling you about all the data. That's a very select sampling of some of the data that was put together by an editor. If you pick up the Nestle-Aland edition of the Greek New Testament, it's got a much more extensive apparatus than the UBS apparatus. But even if you had that, that would also be just a sampling. There are many verses where it doesn't note variants that are quite significant. And if you're just reading through that, you wouldn't even know that there were variants at that place because there's a limited space on the page to list those variants. So even if you have the Nestle-Aland edition, you do not have, quote, all the data in front of you. Even if you took one of the currently in process editions of the ECM, the Editio Critica Major, and it listed for the verses, tries to list, I think, fairly exhaustively the variants and the manuscripts and so forth. There's a sense in which you would not have all the data in front of you, because if you really had all the data in front of you, you would have to have a facsimile or an image of every single manuscript, because in these critical handbooks or critical editions, they're only going to make reference to the manuscript. They're not actually going to show it to you. And the truth is, no single person can sit down and ever hope exhaustively to look at all of the data. You simply cannot do that. What you're going to be looking at in a handbook like the UBS is the editor's selection of some of the data. And let me just add something else. When you embrace the critical text, it doesn't mean you can't pick up the UBS edition or the Nestle-Aland or the ECM, or that you can't go to the virtual manuscript room and look up particular manuscripts, facsimiles, or digital pictures of them, or that you can't go to museums and examine firsthand various codices of papyri. You can do that when you embrace the received text. If you have a historical interest in the process of the transmission of the text, you're not cutting yourself off from that. You're just acknowledging, I'm not depending upon that kind of study to reconstruct the text, but I am accepting the received text, the traditional text of the Protestant faith. So you're not cutting yourself off from all the data by embracing the received text. Again, you're just saying, I can't take this information and ever hope by using reason to reconstruct the original. I instead am trusting that the Holy Spirit has providentially preserved the original in the printed editions of the Reformation era. So let's continue with a few more things he's going to have to say about this first argument.
We literally to this day have more access to more knowledge on the texts and the manuscripts and the fragments than we ever have before.
And I'm not 100% sure that's true. I hear that being said a lot. Really, there's no way to verify that, is there? I mean, is it possible that there were scholars in earlier generations who had access to more material? I get it, because we live in the digital age. Things can be looked up that previously were hidden away in monasteries or in universities. But anyways, when you have a question about the whole Reconstruction enterprise, and you're challenging that, it's not really a winning point to say, hey, we've got more access to some of these manuscripts than we've ever had before. Matthew Solomon, in his article that's in the Myths of Mistakes book, talking about the transmission of scripture, does a deep dive in the book of Philemon. And he says, you know, when all is said and done, there are only, I think, 9 manuscripts of Philemon that are extant that are earlier than the year 700. Well, okay, so what if by using digital images, I can look at all of those manuscripts? Great, but is that enough? Is that enough to reconstruct the original? Those who practice modern textual criticism don't think it's enough, because they say the best we can do is reconstruct what they call the initial text or the Ausgangs text. So I don't get this apologetic point that he's trumpeting here, and I hear from other advocates of the modern critical text like James White and others.
And I truly, truly believe that if Erasmus and Beza had...
I truly, truly, truly believe. Is this a matter of sincerity of belief? Anyways, I truly, truly believe that if Beza and Erasmus had access to the information we have now, then they would embrace the modern critical text. That's essentially what he's going to say. And so I'll let him say it for himself.
Access to the knowledge that we have today, even through the computer digitization of these old ancient manuscripts, so they don't continue to fall apart in our hands as they become dust. They're made out of, you know, such fragmentary pieces of matter. Papyrus is just so brittle and decomposes so easily. I truly believe that if Beza and Erasmus and the others, Stephanus, if they had what we had today, they would be moved to tears, as I was when I was just looking at all of the informational resources. So I think that the critical text is better in that it simply is able to cull and to collate more of the data throughout the ages.
All right, let me pause here. So let's look at this part of his argument. He's saying, this is still under the general umbrella of his first argument, that he wants to have access to all the data. So what he suggests, I've heard this from other people before, is that if Erasmus and Beza and Stephanus had access to all the riches we have today, they would embrace the modern critical text. And as I pondered that, I've heard it from other people too, I jotted down a few objections that I have to this argument. First of all, clearly this is a hypothetical conjecture, and it can never be proven. We can sit around all day and say, well, if Stephanus had access to this, you know, what position would he take on this verse or that verse? It's all hypothetical. We don't know what they would do under certain circumstances. We know what they did do under the historical circumstances in which they lived. Secondly, I think it is incorrect to assume that these men of the past were ignorant of the reality of textual variants in the transmission process. In fact, if you go back and you read these men of the past, men of the Reformation era, they often make reference to and show their knowledge of the major textual issues and disputes that exist down to this day. They were not ignorant of these things, and they knew of alternative readings that were offered in old manuscripts, but by and large, they rejected them in favor of the common text, the ecclesiastical text that was largely being used in their day. third fault that I find with this argument, it doesn't take into consideration the fact that the men of the past, like Erasmus and Beza and Stephanus, that they might have had access to materials that are now lost to us. In fact, it would be, I don't know, modern arrogance, modern hubris to think that we necessarily have access to things that they weren't aware of, when in fact they may have had access to things that we're not aware of. You can look, for example, at Beza's annotations. I've written on this on Revelation 16:5, where he makes reference to the reading that he approves in that verse appearing in an old handwritten manuscript. Scholars have not been able to uncover that manuscript, but he claims in his annotations that he had access to it. So that would be just one example of this. My fourth fault that I would find with this argument, this hypothetical argument, is that the issues related to textual criticism do not merely rest with the data and whether or not these men of the past had access to that data. But the real issue, I think, the heart issue, is that these men were approaching the scriptures from a very different perspective than modern scholars. They were approaching the text of scripture from a pre-critical, pre-enlightenment intellectual and spiritual perspective. That was the milieu in which they operated. Grantley MacDonald, in his recent book on the Coma Ioanneum, makes a distinction between what he calls the pre-critical episteme and the post-critical or the modern episteme. And that's a gap, it's a divide that really can't be bridged. And so it's not just a matter of these men having access to manuscripts that we have access to now. It's a matter of a very different worldview, a very different intellectual and spiritual milieu in which they lived. All right, so that's pretty much covering his first argument, and I think he's going to move on pretty soon here to his second argument. So let's listen to this one.
And I prefer that. So secondly, this debate, in my mind, could really be reduced quite simply to a discussion on whether antiquity or majority is more important in your evaluation of any given reading. So here's what I mean by that.
Okay, so his second argument is going to be that the antiquity of the evidence is more important than the majority of the evidence. So antiquity is more important than majority. So let's listen to him tease out the second argument for him being a critical text guy a little further.
That the critical text largely depends, and I think if we're honest, it largely depends and goes back to text of a more ancient nature and origin than does the Textus Receptus. Now that may be debatable, but certainly we...
Well, okay, it is debatable. It's very debatable, in fact. But it's second argument is going to be that the modern critical text is based on antiquity, whereas the traditional text is based on majority. And sometimes it's said that one of the canons of modern textual criticism is the older manuscripts are to be preferred to later manuscripts. However, I think with all due respect that there seems to be some misunderstandings of this from the perspective of Pastor Everhard, and also some lack of understanding how the field of textual criticism has shifted and changed. Really, I think he's presenting some views that may have had more resonance in the 20th century up to the late 20th century and have decreasing resonance as we go into the 21st century. Let me just point out, I've jotted down here three major problems, I think, with this argument. First of all, when he says that the modern critical text is about antiquity and the traditional text is about majority, First point is, this doesn't take into consideration the fact that the received text, the TR position, is not necessarily based on majority. It agrees largely with the majority text or the Byzantine text, but it is a pre-critical eclectic text. And the TR sometimes prefers readings that are not majority text readings. So Acts 8:37, 1 John 5, 7, and 8, the three heavenly witnesses passage. Those are passages that are in the TR, but they're not the readings of the majority text. So the first problem I have with his argument is he doesn't take into consideration that the TR is also not necessarily a majority text in all cases. Second problem with his argument here is that the modern critical text, likewise, is not exactly as he presents it here. The modern critical text is not always based on the so-called oldest manuscripts. Let me give you an example of this. The traditional ending of Mark, Mark 16, 9 through 20. The oldest evidence for the traditional ending of Mark comes from the second century writings of the church fathers. Clearly, the traditional ending of Mark is made reference to in Justin Martyr, in Tatian's De Tesserone, in Irenaeus of Lyon's writing against heresies. And so the oldest references to the ending of Mark affirm the antiquity and the authenticity of Mark 16, 9 through 20. It's not until we come to Sinaiticus and Vaticanus in the mid-4th century that we find out that there was any challenge to the traditional ending of Mark. So this would be an example of the modern critical text actually chooses a reading that's not the oldest reading. Another example would be the doxology of the Lord's Prayer. Well, the Didache, a apostolic, post-apostolic writing that is usually dated to around the year 100, has a version of the doxology of the Lord's Prayer from Matthew 6, 13b. And so that's the oldest record. And so there's no question about the antiquity of the doxology of the Lord's Prayer, and yet it is omitted in the modern critical text. Third argument against this viewpoint that he puts forward here, the modern critical text method now rejects the whole oldest is best canon. So again, Pastor Everhard, with all due respect, he's putting forward an argument that would have been made in the 19th century on into the 20th century. But in the 21st century, modern textual criticism is nuancing and redefining the oldest manuscripts or the best manuscripts as a canon of textual criticism. To see evidence of this, I would just point Pastor Everhard and anyone else who happens to be listening to the article written by Gregory R. Lanier that appears in the book Myths and Mistakes in New Testament Textual Criticism, edited by Gurry and Hickson. Lanier's article is titled Dating Myths Part 2, How Later Manuscripts Can Be Better Manuscripts. It's found on pages 110 to 131. Again, get the subtitle of this: How Later Manuscripts Can Be Better Manuscripts. And in that article, Lanier offers this kind of confusing summation of his thoughts on pages 111 and 112. Here's the quote: "Sometimes later manuscripts are better manuscripts, though not always. Sometimes later manuscripts are better manuscripts, though not always." And I'm hoping I got that quotation correct, and I just want to make sure that I do, lest Elijah Hickson should accuse me of getting the data wrong. Yes, that's exactly what it says, pages 111 and 112. in italics. Sometimes later manuscripts are better manuscripts, comma, on page 112, though not always. So again, that canon that Everhard puts forward here is one that has shifted. Another example of this would be that in the current newest new method, the coherence-based genealogical method, they now are regularly saying that there are many Byzantine readings that are preferable to readings that come from much earlier manuscripts, like the papyri and some of the oldest uncials. Sometimes they're saying the Byzantine manuscripts, later manuscripts, can provide readings that are better. And so, again, I think the foundation of the argument that he sort of simplistically, with all due respect, I know it's for a popular audience, that he puts forward here is one that has some major flaws within it.
We have discovered manuscripts and papyri that simply were not known at the time of the collation of what is the Textus Receptus.
I'm just making an observation on this, and people who have been listening know this, my response here, pretty well. Yes, the papyri began to be discovered and published in the late 19th and the end of the 20th century, but many modern scholars have made the observation that the discovery of the papyri actually were not essential for the creation of the modern critical text. No, the reformers didn't have access to the papyri, but neither did Westcott and Hort. The modern critical text was based on the discovery and the printing of early uncials, most notably Sinaiticus and Vaticanus. And many scholars have made the observation that actually the discovery of the papyri has not significantly impacted the modern critical Greek text that is found in the modern printed editions, like that of Nesselland and that of UBS. So again, I think his point here is not well-founded.
We now have older things than they had in the 1500s. And so the critical text, if it has to choose between antiquity and majority readings, it seems to prefer antiquity. Whereas, if you're a Textus Receptus advocate, your main argument and must be, and is, an argument based on majority readings. Now, I personally...
No, that's not exactly right. Again, see the argument I made previously about the fact that the TR has Acts 8:37, and it has 1 John 5, 7, and 8. The TR is a pre-critical, eclectic text that we believe was affirmed providentially in the historical process by God. And so it wasn't a text that was decided upon because it represented the majority reading in the majority of extant manuscripts.
Personally, this is where I really struggled with this. I didn't have a dog in the fight. I didn't have a horse in the race, so to speak. I have only an intellectual curiosity and what I think is a pious desire to know the Lord.
I'm glad for the intellectual curiosity and the pious desire, but if you're a pastor of a church, then you do have a dog in the fight, and you have to determine what's the translation I'm going to use. What text am I going to exegete as I prepare to preach? And so every minister of the gospel does have a dog in this fight.
His word. I had a hard time weighing that out. I mean, on one hand, if you've got 100 texts that say one reading, but you have a much older text that has a slight variance, well, which do you weigh as being more important, the majority or that which comes from antiquity, which is older?
And again, we have modern scholars now in the 21st century who are saying that the Byzantine readings are often superior readings because they believe that they are based on older manuscripts than the ones that are now extant. And so this argument, again, I think is less cogent in the 21st century.
A lot of ways, that is the question. That is the state of the art of the question of this entire discussion. Now, one thing that is interesting, and I'm going to come back to this in a minute, the UBS is a great text as far as I'm concerned, but I love what the Cambridge Tyndale House Greek New Testament has done, and that they have basically kind of limited the scope of the manuscripts that they're interested in to the first 500 years of Christian history. If a reading can't be found in the first 500 years, then it's really not considered. They do stretch the boundaries a little bit for the Book of Revelation due to the lesser number of manuscripts and papyri and other fragments that they have of Revelation. I think they go out to as much as the first 800 years of Christianity. But given that so many of the Byzantine texts are later than that, they're newer than that, the weight of the Tyndale House Greek New Testament really does stress antiquity. And this brings me to...
Let me pause here. He talks about the Tyndale House Greek New Testament and the fact that they made as a standard that they would only include readings in the text proper that were of a certain antiquity. And he's going to come back at the end and talk more about the Tyndale House Greek New Testament. And I'll maybe hold off. I've written a review of the Tyndale House Greek New Testament, and I'll put a link. Hopefully I can put a link to my review and you can read it for yourself. But I think there are some problems with the Tyndale House Greek New Testament method, obviously, because I think given the limited amount of evidence, we can't attempt to reconstruct a text of the scriptures purely based on the earliest or manuscripts that are extant that are, you know, below the year 800 or below the year 700, simply because there aren't that many of them. There are very few of them, in fact. But anyways, he's going to go on to his third argument, which is going to be the argument to resist the temptation for English priority. So let me let him present this.
Theoretical new Greek manuscript text that I would love to have. If somebody could set the boundary to try to balance between the antiquity and majority in such a way that you said, okay, let's make this a majority text. Let's make a majority text reading. However,
sorry, I thought he was at the point where he's going to present the third argument. He's talking a little bit more. He'll come back to this at the end also, his desire for there to be a new printing of the majority text. And I think that would be great for him and for other ministers or scholars who are majority text advocates to present their own printed edition of it. I think that would be great because I hear a lot of people these days, I see a lot of them online saying, I'm for the majority text. I'm for the Byzantine text. I don't accept the received text, but I like the majority text. And where is your text exactly? And what translation is out there that is based on the majority text that is widely used among Christians, Protestant Christians especially, but among all denominations of Christians in general?
We're going to set parameters for that, and we're going to limit the parameters to the first 800 years. Then that'd be my text. I think that'd be a fantastic way to do it. I don't know that that's exclusively what the Tyndale House Greek New Testament has done, but I do like the principle of setting some kind of...
No, it's not based on the majority text. It's an eclectic modern text, so they often choose readings that diverge from the majority.
...kind of parameters, because the further you get out in terms of chronology from the writings of the apostles, you do have to kind of weigh, well, if I have, you know, if I have 500 editions, but they're all 1,500 years old or 1,300 years old or whatever, then how much does that truly weigh? So you have to weigh that question out for yourself. I've been thinking about this, and I lean towards antiquity as being more valuable in considering a reading than majority.
So does this mean that you embrace the traditional ending of Mark because it's attested by the earliest witnesses, by the church fathers of the second century? Or do you go along with the modern critical text, which puts the traditional ending of Mark in brackets? So again, to embrace the modern critical text is not necessarily to embrace the oldest text, the oldest extant manuscripts that bear witness to the text.
You could disagree with that, and you'll have your own conclusions, but that's what I came up with. The next item for me is I think it's very, very important that we resist the temptation of what I will call English priority. And here's what I mean by that. If you are choosing your Greek New Testament text based on your preference for an English translation, then I think I would suggest you're doing that exactly backwards. I think we should select our English translation based on our preference of the Greek New Testament text, not the other way around. Now, that may bear some consideration for those of you who are in the King James onlyist camp.
Let me pause here, okay, and offer a few observations on this third point. Resist the temptation for English priority. Well, I would largely agree here. Yes, I think when it comes to the text of Scripture, it is largely an issue of the original text first, and not primarily an issue of translation. And I think the easiest thing to do is to say, as a confessional Christian, and Pastor Everhard is a Presbyterian minister who adheres to the Westminster Confession of Faith. I'm a Reformed Baptist pastor who adheres to the Second London Baptist Confession of Faith. But chapter one of both of our confessions is essentially the same. And paragraph eight, the Old Testament in Hebrew, which was the native language of the people of God of old, and the New Testament in Greek, which at the time of the writing of it was most generally known to the nations, being immediately inspired by God and by his singular care and providence kept pure in all ages, are therefore authentic. And so we believe that the Bible was immediately inspired in the original Hebrew with respect to the Old Testament, two places in Aramaic, a cognate language to ancient or classical Hebrew, and the New Testament was immediately inspired in Greek. That means it wasn't immediately inspired in Dutch or in French or in English or in Hungarian. And so any view that would say that the Bible is immediately inspired in a translation would necessarily be one that contradicts the confession. Now, the confession does go on in chapter 1, paragraph 8, to discuss the role of translations, as it continues and says in paragraph 8, but because these original tongues are not known to all the people of God, who have a right unto an interest in the Scriptures and are commanded in the fear of God to read and search them, therefore they are to be translated into the vulgar language of every nation unto which they come. And so, yes, the Bible should be translated, and translations are valuable to the degree that they accurately present the immediately inspired original languages. So, yes, we should not be guided, certainly with an English priority, I would say a vernacular priority, but I think, unfortunately, underlying Pastor Everhard's argument here is the argument against the received text, that we only defend the received text because we are closet KJV onlyists. That's the only reason that we prefer the TR with respect to the New Testament and the Masoretic text with respect to the Hebrew Old Testament. But let me let him say a little bit more about this, and I'll have another response to his point here.
Because I think, and I could be wrong here, but I suspect that a lot of the arguments in defense of the TR only position is really only sort of a cover for a defense of King James only advocacy. And if that's true, and only you would know that in your heart, then I think that is backwards. If you love the new King James, the NKJV, and you think the TR is right because ultimately you want to defend the new King James, then that's, I think that's backwards.
All right. So again, he says that if he has a sense that people who defend the TR, they're really just cloaking their defense of the King James Version. And let me respond to this. The Trinitarian Bible Society is generally known as an organization that defends the traditional text. I mean, they have kept in print since the 1970s, Scribner's Greek New Testament. And I'm very privileged that I'm going to be going to London in September the 15th of this year. And I was invited to give a talk at a conference that the TBS is holding. It's called the Text and Translation Conference. And it's going to be at the Tyndale House, not the Tyndale House at Cambridge, which is an evangelical think tank study center, but this is Tyndale House, which is the headquarters of TBS in London. And I'm going to be one of four men who are going to be doing presentations. I'm going to be giving a presentation on defending the TR. But two of the four presentations that are going to be made are going to be made on translations of the Bible, not into English, not about the King James Version, but Pastor Puyan Mershai is going to do a presentation on the translation that the TBS is supporting of the Bible from the traditional underlying text into Farsi, into the Persian language. And then Bill Greendike, who is the head of the TBS in the U.S., is going to be doing a presentation on the recently sponsored TBS translation of the Bible into Spanish. They've completed the Spanish New Testament. And so two of the four presentations are not going to be about the King James Version. They're going to be about how we're using the underlying traditional text to make translations into other languages. So there may be some people who only defend the TR because they're committed to the authorized version, but that's certainly not true of all. And if they're confessional and they hold to chapter 1 and paragraph 8, then they believe that the Bible is immediately inspired in the original languages. Just another evidence of this, I also recently received an invitation to go to Budapest, Hungary. And God willing, I'm going to go to Hungary late October, early November, and talk about the traditional texts of Scripture in a Hungarian Reformed Baptist church there. The only, actually, Hungarian Reformed Baptist church in Hungary, the Soli Deo Gloria Reformatus Baptista Reformalt Baptista Dulakazet in Budapest. And these guys are not asking me to come there because they want to use the King James Version. They're asking me to come there because they want a Hungarian translation that is based on the traditional text. And they're interested in the idea of the traditional Protestant text underlying their translation of the Bible. So this, I agree with you. We should resist the temptation to think of this as only a matter of vernacular translation. It's a matter of the immediately inspired Hebrew and the immediately inspired Greek. Now, on the other hand, however, I will add that as simply as an English-speaking Protestant Christian, and I think simply as a Protestant in general, whether you're English-speaking or not, you should not ignore the value and the influence of the authorized version as a standard English translation of the Bible. Certainly, it is the standard English translation. It's the standard by which all modern translations are measured. And also, it's a translation, I think, that had an influence in, we could say, the world Protestant movement. I did a podcast interview with a brother from Sweden who was talking about how when they started working on a Swedish translation of the Bible based on the traditional Protestant text, that they often consulted the authorized version and other important early Protestant translations of the Bible because they wanted their Swedish translation to be in harmony with, we could say, the world Protestant usage. And so we shouldn't have to make any excuses about seeing the King James Version as a very important, vital, and significant, and highly influential Protestant translation of the Bible. And I don't think it is overstating it to say that it is the most important Protestant translation of the Bible in any language. And it had more influence upon the world Protestant movement than any other translation. So why should we ignore that? Even when people accuse us of being KJV only, it would be foolish to ignore the historical significance of the authorized version. Anyways, let's go on.
But the argument works both ways, because if you love the NIV or the NASB or the ESV or the LSB or many of the other newer English translations, and you're going to choose the critical text only because you love the ESV, then that too is backwards.
Well, I do appreciate the fact that Pastor Everhard here is you know, saying that this argument can be taken in, you know, from two sides, that there might be people out there who prefer the modern critical text because they love the ESV. And that also would be wrong, simply to prefer the translation, to prefer the text because it's the one that underlies your translation. On the other hand, if we're preaching from the King James Version, obviously, as I am, I need to access in exegesis to a good printed edition of the TR. And if someone's out there using the ESV, I'm assuming they need access to the modern critical text. Again, we've got a whole nother discussion about whether they should be preaching from the ESV. I think there are major problems with the ESV versus whether they should be preaching from the standard Protestant translation of the Bible in their native tongue. But anyways, I do appreciate the fact that he points out that this knife cuts in two ways.
And so I've had to ask myself that very question. Do I love the critical text because I'm an ESV guy? Or should I love the ESV because I'm a critical text guy? So either way, I think if we're working from English to the Greek, we're probably doing it backwards. And I had to do a soul search to make sure I wasn't defending a preferred Greek text based on a preferred English translation. And I think it would be fair for all of us to ask ourselves that same question. Next, and this has been helpful for me, I have found the conspiracy theories to be uncompelling. Now, most...
All right, so this is going to be his fourth point. And it is going to be, fourth point is reason as to why he has become a modern critical text guy and not a TR advocate, is because he has found that the conspiracy theories are not compelling. And I have to say that one of my complaints on this point, this is my least favorite of the 5 points that he puts forward, because Everhard is very vague here. And he doesn't really tell us what these conspiracy theories are. He sort of hints at somewhat towards the end of this. And anyways, let me just let him tease this out, and then I'll offer a response to it.
Most of the conspiracy theories are not necessarily from the TR-only advocate brothers, but more so from the KJV-only advocate brothers.
So he says these conspiracy theories, unnamed, unexplained, are really, though, not from the TR only guys. Again, we can talk about that term, but from the KJVO guys. So he's making a charge here primarily at people who are KJV only. We can have a whole nother discussion. You need to define who is a KJV onlyist, because there's a vast difference between someone who prefers the King James Version and someone who... maybe a Gil Ripplinger type person who has a sort of a superstitious view about the King James Version or uses numerology or other things like that. And very often what people do is they use the term KJV only falsely to label those who simply prefer the King James Version as an English translation. In fact, my anecdotal experience is that there really aren't very many KJV onlyists out there, but there are a lot of people who like to label people who prefer the King James Version as King James Version onlyists. But anyways, my frustration with this is he never clearly defines what these so-called conspiracy theories are. And instead of clearly explaining them, he sort of lampoons them, talks about UFOs and such. But anyways, let me let him talk for himself here.
And I've looked into several of these conspiracy theories, and I just don't think there's any there, if that makes sense. I don't find them to be rationally persuasive to me. Now, as I say that, let me just say, hey, I'll hear out your conspiracy theory, man. You want to tell me about UFOs? I would love to hear what you've heard about UFOs or seen or whatever. If you've got a rational explanation for the JFK assassination, or if you know something about the moon landing that I don't know, man, I am all ears. I'm I'm down for good conspiracy theory. I'll give you a fair listen. And I gave some of these conspiracy theories a fair listen when it came to the text issues. And
now, again, if I could just candidly speak, is this really being charitable here? Is this really being fair to those who have concerns about the modern critical text? That's what it's going to come down to. The conspiracy theories, as you'll allude to later, are going to be basically traditional Christians who have concerns about the motivations of those, particularly in the 19th and on into the 20th century, who have a desire to alter the text of the Bible and to topple the received text and replace it with the modern critical text. Now, just an observation here. I mean, we're living in an era in the United States where there have been lots of people in the last 2 years, people in government, people in media, who have used their power to dismiss things that were actually true by calling them conspiracy theories. And if someone they disagree with politically criticizes them or suggests that they had an improper motive for doing something, there's been an attempt to dismiss their objections because that's fake news or that's a conspiracy theory. But what's happened here recently is we found out that some of these so-called conspiracy theories actually ended up being true. And I want to suggest that there might possibly be a parallel here. There have been traditional Christians over the years who have said, I'm concerned about the fact that there were liberal theologians, liberal practitioners of the modern historical critical method who may have had a motivation to change the traditional texts of Scripture in such a way that reflected their own theology. Could something like that actually have happened? Could there have been men influenced by the Enlightenment, men influenced by a Darwinian worldview? Could there have been Unitarians, theological liberals, people who didn't believe that the earliest Christians believed that Jesus was God, but instead they believed that so-called high Christology was a later development? And if we find texts, early texts, with respect to dating that seem to reflect a lower Christology, they're more authentic because they express primitive Christianity. Are we saying that the textual critics of the 19th century were not influenced by the Enlightenment, that they were not influenced by rationalism, that they were not influenced by Unitarianism, Arianism, and so forth? Are we saying that modern scholars working in the 21st century in the area of textual criticism are not influenced by postmodernism? I think that some people might try to dismiss those arguments as being conspiracy theories, but in the end, it might be found that they're actually true. As I was listening to this, I thought of two quotations that came to my mind. And they both come from academic scholars. One was a quotation that came to my mind from Michael Horton, who's a evangelical, reformed, prolific writer. And a couple years back, I read and did a review of his systematic theology titled Christian Faith. And there was a quotation in there when he was discussing Christology that stuck out in my brain. I noted it in my back cover of my copy, and every once in a while I thought about it again. But in Michael Horton's book, Christian Faith, in its discussion of Christology, he makes this statement on page 464 and 465. He said, quote, "The liberal trajectory is essentially Arian or adoptionist," end quote. The liberal trajectory is Arian. Now, he was saying that in systematic theology, there's a tendency in liberal systematic theology to take an Arian view of Jesus, to say that Jesus was a great man, an exalted creature, but to deny Nicene Trinitarian view of the Lord Jesus Christ. And if that's true of systematicians, do you think that's probably not also true of biblical scholars in the 19th century, those who worked with the text? Am I just talking conspiracy theories here, or do you see any merit at all to the possibility of that? The second quotation that came to mind is from something that I'm in the midst of reading right now. I'm in the midst of reading the memoir of Thomas C. Oden. His memoir is titled A Change of Heart. And Oden was at Drew for many years. And he famously, the first half of his life, as he says in his memoir, his first 40 years, he was basically a classical liberal, a socialist, was in the church of what's happening now. And then when he was about 40 years old, he experienced a conversion of sorts. I don't know if he would call it, you know, a conversion with respect to saving faith. But he changed his approach to Christianity from liberalism to wanting to pursue traditional Christianity. And so the second half of his life, the last 40 or so years of his life, were devoted to learning about and propagating traditional Christianity. And he has a quotation on page 81 of the memoir. And like I said, I'm about halfway through it, but this one really stuck out. And he was talking about his early years as a teacher. I mean, he went to Yale, did his PhD there. You know, he taught at, he was a Methodist. He taught in some of their seminaries. He taught at Drew. And he's talking about his early years. And this is the quotation from page 81. He writes, "In my seminary teaching, I appeared to be relatively orthodox." That's orthodox with a small o, not Eastern Orthodox, but orthodox like holding to right doctrine. If by that one means using an orthodox vocabulary, I could still speak of God, sin, and salvation, but always only in demythologized, secularized, and worldly wise terms. Let me pause here for a moment. Oden was a Bultmannian, so he could use traditional Christian language, but he had just completely reinterpreted all of it. He had demythologized all of it. He continues in this quotation, page 81. "God became the liberator, sin became oppression, and salvation became human effort. The trick was to learn to sound Christian while undermining traditional Christianity," end quote. So here we have Thomas Oden saying, when I was a liberal theologian, I used orthodox language, but the trick was to sound Christian while in fact I was undermining traditional Christianity. Now, do you think that's a conspiracy theory? Or do you think Oden's experience might reflect those of many mainstream scholars, even ones who identified as Christian, even those who identified as churchmen in the 19th, 20th, and even into the 21st century to a certain degree? So anyways, let's pick it back up. He's soon going to get to his fifth and final point.
And I found them to be rationally unpersuasive. So I do not believe, for instance, that the motivation of the critical text is to remove verses from the Greek New Testament. I don't believe that is true. If that were to be true, you would have to have some sort of a 2-millennia-long cover-up where the modern Bible publishers are working in conspiracy with the Alexandrians of old and throughout the ages.
Well, Bible publishers haven't been working for 2 millennia. I mean, the Bible's only been in print since 1516, the Greek text 1516 with Erasmus. And so do you know anyone who's saying there was a conspiracy between those who produced the Alexandrian manuscripts and Bible publishers? No, but it's the type of thing that Oden talked about in that quotation that I just gave you, that there are people who are influenced by the Enlightenment, the spirit of this age, the zeitgeist of this age, and they're using their learning in a way to remove Christianity from traditional Christianity. And it's not a conspiracy theory to suggest that that very thing might well have happened. It did happen, in fact, in the 19th and into the 20th century.
Is to remove certain verses from old ancient manuscripts.
It's not as simplistic as them simply wanting to remove verses. Again, it's an entire worldview that is in play, an entire theology that is at play.
Scripts and papyri, and I just find that incredible to the point of unbelievability.
Well, just look at the writings of Bart Ehrman, where he talks about we should forget about trying to find the original text of the Bible. Instead, we should think of the textual transmission process as windows into early Christianity. Why can he say that? Because he's not a Christian. He's not a believer. And he doesn't believe in the providential preservation of Scripture. And he doesn't believe actually in any definitive Christianity, singular. He believes in Christianities. And then take a look at modern scholars who have picked up exactly the same language as Bart Ehrman. Not all these people have done so purposefully. They've not all done it with evil motives, although perhaps there have been some who have approached it in that way. But they've been sometimes unknowingly influenced by the spirit of this age. That's what we're talking about. And I don't think that's a conspiracy theory that can be easily just rejected, denied, or ignored.
Neither do I find convincing that there is some sort of a deleterious moral nature to the Alexandrian manuscripts.
Okay, this is going to be his fifth argument, I think. He's going to transition to this. He rejects the notion, as he puts it, that there is a moral nature to the Alexandrian manuscripts. And so let's listen as he's going to tease out this fifth and final point.
As over against the Byzantine manuscripts. Now, again, for those of you who aren't, you know, maybe you're not up on the discussion here, the majority of the New Testament manuscripts that we have today are of a Byzantine nature. They come from the region formerly known as Cappadocia, more modernly known as Turkey, Asia Minor, etc. And they are numerically the majority. However, they are newer in time. They're not as old as some of the Alexandrian manuscripts. And so a lot of the conspiracy theory argument basically says, look, Alexandria, bad place. Those guys were bad. They were evil. They were heretics. Whereas the Cappadocians, whereas the Byzantines, all good. They were saints. They were pure. They had better intentions. They were better scholars. Yeah, I just don't attribute morality to geographic region. And so though many people have made the argument that Alexandria was a bad place, shake your finger at Alexandria. I'm sorry, it just didn't work. It just didn't work as an argument for me.
All right, let me pause here. Let's look at this argument. So he says, he rejects, it's kind of a tailing off the last point about, he says this is a conspiracy theory, that there's a moral nature to the Alexandrian manuscripts. And what he's getting at is that some traditionalists have said we should be careful about the papyri and even unsealed manuscripts that come from Egypt and from Alexandria, because Alexandria, we know from church history, was often a hotbed of heterodoxy. And that doesn't mean necessarily that we reject everything that came out of Egyptian Christianity. I don't know anyone who suggests that. If we have heterodox views that arise in Asia Minor, we should reject those as well. So we shouldn't judge things purely based on the geographical area, but we should base them on the theology, the thought that comes from those, from wherever they come from, whatever their origin. But two observations about his argument here. First of all, his descriptions here, and I think his approach, is a bit outdated, because modern textual scholars now suggest that the text types that Pastor Eberhard makes reference to here, the whole concept of the text types really don't work. In fact, they were applied usually in discussions of the Gospels, but not really so much in the Pauline epistles and other parts of the New Testament. And whereas in previous generations, people talked about the Alexandrian manuscripts and the Western manuscripts and even the Caesarean manuscripts and the Byzantine manuscripts. Those who use the CBGM, for example, have said that these text types, it's not really a useful term. The only text type they do continue to make reference to are the Byzantine manuscripts. But anyway, so the first point is his approach here is a bit outdated. My second comment about his approach here is that there's a major problem with those who rely on reconstruction, and it is the fact that we don't know much about the provenance or the origin of many of these manuscripts. And if you say there's no moral difference between manuscripts found in one location and manuscripts found in another, that may obscure the fact that we really don't know a lot about where many of these manuscripts come from. And it might also obscure the fact that, yes, there were heterodox groups in early Christianity, and no doubt they did produce manuscripts. And these groups and their texts were in conflict with those who held to an orthodox view of the faith and the texts that they preserved and transmitted. And we do know for sure that there were heterodox groups that were unafraid to tamper with the text. All you need to do is read Irenaeus, read Tertullian as they describe Marcion and the Marcionites and how they mutilated the text of Scripture. And they tried to take out the parts they didn't like and only keep the parts that they did like. For the Marcionites, they took out, you know, any references to the Old Testament because they didn't believe the Old Testament. They thought the God of the Old Testament was an evil demiurge. And so they weren't afraid to mutilate the text of Scripture. And Irenaeus and Tertullian complained about that. Or you can read the writings of Augustine, who said that there were people who were tampering with the text and trying to remove the passage about the woman taken in adultery because they were offended by the ethics of it. How could Jesus have forgiven someone who broke the seventh commandment and committed adultery? And so they were offended on an ethical level, and so they tried to remove that passage from the text. And so are you really going to say that there isn't a moral difference and a theological difference in early Christian communities, and this would affect the text? And are you also going to acknowledge that we really don't know the provenance, the origins of many of these even earliest manuscripts? We don't know the provenance of Sinaiticus or Vaticanus. We don't know where it came from. We don't know whether it came from an Orthodox group or a heterodox group. And that's true of many of the fragments of the papyri as well. Are we really going to change our traditional Bible based on conjectures about scraps of papyri manuscripts that come from isolated locations? We don't know anything about their origins. So again, I think the issue is a lot more nuanced than Pastor Everhard lets on here in his discussion. So we're in the midst here of his fifth and final point. So I'm just going to play some more, and after he finishes with this fifth and final point, he's going to draw some conclusions. So let's continue.
So for those basic reasons, I have decided, as far as I know my own heart, that I'm going to be a critical text guy. And that doesn't mean that I don't love the Textus Receptus. I realize, of course, that the King James Version is a magnificent English translation, that the Lord did in fact use the King James as well as the Textus Receptus in the Reformation era for...
It's very interesting. Often the people who embrace the modern critical text, they often say, you know, I want you to know, I love the TR, I love the King James Version, but... There's always a but. It's kind of like, you know, the stereotype of someone breaking up with someone. It's not you, but it's me. There's nothing wrong with you, but it's really me. So anyways, my question is, if you love the TR, if you love the King James Version, then why not embrace it? Why not use it? But he's going to give us some reasons as to why, despite his love of the TR and the King James Version, he's going to choose not to embrace it.
Great. await ends and to bring about the revival of his church. However, I also see the Lord working marvelously through the critical text as well. And I don't buy the rationale that he's blessed the one and he has cursed the other.
Well, I mean, I can argue with you a little bit on this. I mean, really, how long have we had the modern critical text, the modern printed critical text? It's been, you know, if we date it to Westcott and Hort, that's 1881, so about 150 years. We've had the Protestant TR in printed form since 1516 with Erasmus gave the foundation for it, and then you had the mature Protestant editions. You could talk about, you know, Stephanus's 1551 or Beza's 1598. And then it produced all the Protestant translations, the classic Protestant translations, ones that were created in English, the whole Tyndale, Geneva, King James Version tradition. But then translations produced in other languages, in Dutch, in French, in German, in Hungarian. And basically the Protestant movement spread through those translations of the traditional texts and still are used and loved by many even today after, you know, some 400 or 500 years. Now, also, we believe that the printed text of the TR faithfully represents the traditional text of the church. So we would say that it's, you know, it's had 2,000 years of showing itself to be useful, nearly 2,000 years now. Can we really compare that with the 150 years or so of the modern critical text? In addition, though, just on the track record of the 150 years, what has modern criticism and modern theology brought to the church? And can we make some judgments about the influence of modern theology as opposed to classic traditional theology represented in these different printed editions of the Bible? Anyway, let's continue.
Doesn't work for me. So here's my plan for the foregoing future, just so you know where Matt Everhart is at on this topic right now, if you care where I'm at on this topic. First, my future plans. Number one, I'm going to finish my devotions in the UBS 4. I just have to. I'm so far into it now. It would be crazy to turn around and change my mind about anything at this point. So I'm going to finish up.
So he's apparently in a process, I guess, of reading through the Greek New Testament. And so he's been doing that in the fourth edition of the UBS. Actually, there's a fifth corrected edition now. So he's using an old one. I'm guessing it's probably the one he picked up when he was in seminary. And so that's great. That's great. I commend him for that. And, you know, I think that we who are ministers, we ought to know the original languages. We ought to regularly be reading through them. We ought to be certainly exegeting them, preparing to preach and teach from the originals. And so I commend him for that. But he's saying, you know, what is this new conviction that he's expressing? He's a critical text guy. What's that going to do to his reading plan? And so here we go.
My translation work on this. I only have a few books to go, and I'm full steam ahead, ready to do that. Second, when I complete the UBS 4, there is a strong possibility that I'm going to switch over to the Tyndale House Greek New Testament. I love what they did. I think it was brilliant to start with the Tregellis work, and I think it was brilliant to limit the scope, for the most part, to the most ancient manuscripts, especially within the first 500 years. That's what I really care about. I don't so much care about the most recent 500 years of manuscripts. I want to know what was in the first 500 years of manuscript.
But what if the ones from the first 500 years were corrupt and came from heterodox sources, whereas the ones from the last 500 years were ones that faithfully relayed orthodox sources, even if those sources no longer exist in an extant form?
And I think that the Tyndale House does an awesome job of collating that information for us. Having said that, if there was some discussion about a new printed TR text, some of my friends online are talking about maybe publishing something like that, a new edition of the Textus Receptus, And I instantly emailed those guys and I said, please, 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 we already have that. We already have that from a Trinity TBS, right? Trinitarian Bible Publishers.
He's trying to say Trinitarian Bible Society.
Is that right? I get the acronym right?
No.
We already have that. We already have one of those. Please, please, please do a majority text, a straight majority. Give me a text with a straight majority. I would love that. I think that'd be awesome to have. And you can include the majority of texts, every single one of them. It'd be even better if it was a majority text from the first 1,000 years or the first 500 years. I think that would be awesome. We need a new publication of the majority reading text, because as far as I know, the other ones that exist are either really expensive or no longer in print.
Let me pause here for just a moment, because he makes a reference here. I mean, first of all, he talks about the fact that he's going to start using the Tyndale House Greek New Testament. And again, I've done a review of the Tyndale House Greek New Testament. There's some things about it that I find commendable. I like the fact that they include Mark 16, 9 through 20 in the text proper with no brackets. On the other hand, there are some things about the Tyndale House Greek New Testament that I do not like. And one of those is it completely removes the woman taken in adultery passage from the text proper and relegates it to the footnotes. And I'd be curious to hear from Pastor Everhard, if he's going to start reading the Tyndale House Greek New Testament, is he comfortable with that? Does he reject the authenticity of the woman taken in adultery passage? Does he think that should just be taken out of the text proper? Should ministers preach upon it? I'm curious as to whether or not he's ever done an exposition through the Gospel of John. Would he choose not to preach on John 7:53 through 8:11? The other thing I find interesting here is he makes reference to some friends of his, online friends, who are talking about doing a new printed edition of the TR. And here he's making reference to some other guys that I know to a greater or lesser degree, including Stephen Hackett and Dwayne Green. And I know they've been talking about doing a new printed edition, sort of a critical edition of the TR. And I sort of agree with Matthew Everhard here. I really don't think those guys should be doing that. I think people should be producing printed editions of the TR who believe that it is the text of the Word of God and who affirm it. So I think the Trinitarian Bible Society is, in our generation, the proper steward for the TR. And it really, what's the purpose of producing it if you're not someone who believes it's the Word of God and you don't make use of it? I agree with Everhard. I think Hackett and Green, and now we could count perhaps Everhard, although he says he's a critical text guy. Sounds like he kind of, you know, is sort of wanting to lean between the critical text and the majority text or the Byzantine text. Why don't those guys produce a modern edition of the majority text? That's the text they prefer. Why not produce a critical text of that? Because there's, as he said, there's not one that's you know, available in an inexpensive form. There are a couple of editions. You've got Pickering's edition, which Dwayne Green helped do the layout for, I discovered recently. You can find that on Amazon, but there's not really a nice edition of the majority text. Again, you have Maurice Robinson's Byzantine text form, but I think those are a bit pricey. So anyways, why not do that and just leave the TR alone unless you're an advocate for it? And so again, I think the Trinitarian Bible Society is the proper steward in our generation for that. Although I might mention, I have heard that there is another ecclesiological group that is considered doing a printed edition of the TR. We'll see how that develops. I'm sure I'll do a review of it if it ever comes out. I'll probably do a review of the Hackett and Green TR if that came out too as well. But again, I agree with Everhard that they ought to probably stick with doing the majority text since that's the text that they prefer. We're almost at the end. And man, this has been a lot longer than I thought it was going to be. But let's go all the way. We're going to listen to the whole thing. And so here are his final comments.
Finally, and I'll end with this. I am open to listening to arguments on any specific given reading. I'm still going to remain open to it because I want to be rational, logical, a person in which logical persuasion and reason avails. That's kind of who I want to be. So I'll listen to any argument on any text, and if we can go into to Mark's longer ending, that is great. If you want to talk John's Gospel and some of the difficult readings there, or 1 John with me, I will hear any argument. However, at this point, I am going to use the critical text and critical text translations. That's where I've come down. You can disagree with me, and I'd love it if you did. In fact, you can comment on this YouTube video and tell me where I'm wrong. But know this, no matter what side you choose, I do love you lots, and I will chat with you later. See ya.
All right.
What's up, everybody? Whoops. Pastor Matty.
We don't want to start over again. We'll stop right there. All right. So we have listened to the entirety of Pastor Everhard's video describing why he has come to the position where he is a critical text guy and not a TR advocate or a TR only advocate, as he puts it. Again, I appreciate his charitable attitude. He does seem like quite a charitable person. And I haven't yet met him in person. I hope our paths will cross at some time and we can meet in person. And I certainly would look forward to that. I would respectfully disagree with the conclusions that he reaches for the reasons that I have put forward here in a brief span in this response. And I hope that anyone listening to this would carefully consider these matters. And if you are a minister of the gospel, if you are an elder in a church or you aspire to such, you are going to have to make the decision about what is going to be the text of the Bible that you're going to read. What is the translation you're going to use based on that text? What text are you going to exegete? And I just want to put forward that I think there is every reason why it would be wise for you to embrace the traditional text, the received text, the text that has been so helpful for so many over the generations. And I think that it's not burying your head in the sand. It's not being anti-intellectual to embrace the received text. There are good, sound reasons for embracing. And I hope we've touched on at least a few of those points. Well, this is going to bring this Word magazine to a conclusion. I appreciate you listening and those of you who offer feedback and those who offer encouragement. I'll look forward to speaking to you in the next Word magazine. Till then, take care and God bless.